It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
It's the True Faith Newcastle United podcast. Newcastle beat Sheffield United to confirm their relegation. It was 5-1 at St James's Park as Newcastle United march on into Europe, potentially sixth place. An excellent day of football results in the Premier League for us anyway. And now, Alex, and I've got Norman Riley, Sean Robson and Simon Campbell to talk to you about what happened and why. Si, it was a really good win in the end. I think any win by four goals in the Premier League should be celebrated. But you don't think you learned too much about Newcastle United from that one?
Yes, it's almost like you knew exactly what I was going to say there. Because that is my exact point. Yes, I don't think we learned much. Newcastle started badly, as we've done in lots of games this season, especially against poorer oppositions. Now, I suppose we should have anticipated that this was Sheffield United's last kind of bastion of hope for staying in the Premier League, and they were going to give it a bit of a go, and they did. You know, they came a little bit gung-ho, which I think caught us off guard to an extent, and Brereton Diaz in particular was just running along our back line and causing all sorts of problems, and we didn't really have an answer to it in the first 20 minutes. And then they took the lead, and we kind of struggled to get ourselves back in the game, and I would almost argue that our equaliser, whilst a brilliant goal, came out of nothing. It wasn't like we'd suddenly turned the tide. We just got a goal and thought, right, how are lads? We need to sort this out. And I just think I didn't expect us to do anything other than win. Even at half time at 1-1, I was like, it's all right, we're going to win the game, but we haven't played very well. And then as it turns out, the second half was very good. But I just think there's nothing about that performance or that result that really tells you how we're going to get on in the next four games. So I enjoyed it. It was nice to see five goals again. But I'm a little bit confused about what we are now. Like, are we good again? Are we going to be good next week against Burnley? I don't know.
I think we're good at home.
Yeah. I mean, we've got one more of those.
Yeah, we're just the one. I think it's an interesting one. I don't know that I haven't learned anything from it. I think we'll get into kind of the other bits that we've taken from it, including sort of how might want to play and things like that. But I agree with you. I didn't expect us to lose. I didn't expect us to, even though Sheffield were the better side and should have been, it's sort of, talking to people, you think they should have been 2-3 up at half time. And then by the end of the game, we should have scored 9. Yeah. So it's quite a weird one. I think for me, what I've learned is that this is just this crazy inconsistent season. Mm-hmm. And you can't bank on anything necessarily. And we do have to sort of pull our finger out at points and not rest on the fact that, well, Sheffield are probably going down and they're a bit shit, so it's fine and we'll be fine, because that's just not the case. They come out guns blazing. They didn't have enough in the tank to kind of keep that going throughout the match, and we definitely exploited that. But maybe I haven't learned anything. I feel like I learned a lot, but now I can't articulate any of it. Great for a podcast.
Can having something confirmed be a form of learning?
Yes.
All right then. So I thought I learned yesterday, had confirmed that Dan Burn's actually a very effective Premier League centre-half. I thought he had an excellent game, and his game was so much superior to what we've seen from him playing as a left-back most of the season. A couple of the blocks that he made, like last-ditch blocks, were superb. I thought he actually led very well at the back. You know, when we were struggling with Archer's pace, with Brereton Diaz's movement, and I suppose I have learned that actually Dan Burn, for me, is a player who can definitely do a job next season as a centre-half, whereas a couple of months ago when he was playing left-back, you had fans looking and thinking, this lad's going to be, he's going to be a major weak point next season, but actually as a left-sided centre-half, no, to me, he looks like he can be a strength. So I learned that, and I also learned we have a young, potentially useful Premier League player in Alex Murphy, who is a left-sided centre-half and left-back. So there you go, and there's two things I learned after that game. How about that?
I think at this point of the season, performances aren't that relevant. Now, that doesn't feel good when you get beat like we did in the week. But I think right now, if you look at Man United yesterday and you look at Newcastle yesterday, both had home games against the two worst teams in the league statistically at the minute. And both just had to win, and Newcastle did, and Man United didn't. And that's my main takeaway from that is, Newcastle, first half, Newcastle probably should be 3-1 down. probably, and that's pretty poor. And I wasn't happy at halftime. I don't think many fans would have thought what they saw in the first half was in any way good. But A, football games are more than just one half, and B, Newcastle won 5-1. And Newcastle's goal difference gets another boost. They've now scored 73 goals. They've scored 48 goals at home, which is more than anyone else in the division, which is pretty remarkable. We're close to... We've already broken our own goal-scoring record for a 20-league season. I think Newcastle scored 82 goals in 93-94, was 22-league season. We're going to break that, most likely. So they just got the job done, and that's the main thing. And I just feel now, as we head to Burnley, I just want us to get the job done there. If we play shit and win, if we play... terribly and have to rely on a contentious call or whatever, we just have to win more games than Manchester United from here on in. Nothing else matters much. I think the worries about next season, which we have done a lot of, and the fans in general have been thinking, okay, well, you know, when you start to get players back, when you start to have more rest, we've seen performances like Wednesday at Palace. I think all of that can wait now because we just need to finish sixth. Because for me, the Europa League is so superior to the Conference in terms of prestige, probably in terms of income, in terms of being a serious pathway to the Premier League, the Champions League, outside of league place finish. The most important thing Newcastle can do now is just finish sixth. And they did what Man United couldn't yesterday. And to be fair to Sheffield United, I thought they gave a good account of themselves at Old Trafford as well. But Man United needed to win that game against Sheffield with a lot more jeopardy and much later on than we did. That game was over by the 60th minute yesterday, and they got the job done. That's the most important thing. It's all about wins. It's all about moving up the league table. And right now, after the disappointment of Wednesday and the fact that Man United's next three look much trickier than our next three, you'd say that Newcastle are favourites for that sixth place. And that's an important place to come out of yesterday, because at this stage of the season, even if you do the business or get the win as we did, it's only a good day because of what Man United do. So yesterday was a very... And not just Man United, to be fair. West Ham and Chelsea also dropping points. Brighton too, possibly. I don't know if they played or not. They're not very good. Good day yesterday. Good weekend. Let's go and have another one next week.
I think the only other thing I'd say I'd learned, and I probably didn't need to learn this, but Callum Wilson still got it. And that's probably really, really important for the last four games, having another option, because what went wrong at Crystal Palace, mainly for me, whilst others were talking about the selection and the lineup and the formation, was just our lack of potency. And Isak had an off game, and Gordon had an off game. And now that we've got Wilson backfiring, there's just another option there. It means he can hold one of them back and have an impact sub. It might be Barnes again. It might be, we've got some options. And I think that's really important for these last four games, is that if plan A doesn't work, there are other ways we can try and win the game. Whereas up to now, it's kind of felt like if plan A doesn't work, oh, well, we move on to next week. Whereas I'm quite enthused that Wilson's going to be part of those last four games and be really important for us.
I agree. We just need to wrap these pecs in cotton wool.
Well, you wanted to talk about the bench, Charlotte. So why not?
Why not indeed? Yeah, no, I think it's a great point, Si, and it's one that I was interested by yesterday, is that what the substitutions said to me. And if we're talking about learnings, I guess this is what I learned, although I feel like we already knew it, so maybe it's a confirmation. Is that the substitutions made to me speak to how Eddie Howe really wants us to be playing. Like he wants us to have this incredibly attacking style of football. He wants us to be just bombing up the pitch and scoring goals and all of that stuff. And we haven't been able to do it. We saw it in the Aston Villa game in August, how we were 3-1 up, and he made substitutions, and you sort of think, okay, taking off tired legs, just shoring up the defence. Nope, he made attacking substitutions. He brought on Harvey Barnes. He brought on Callum Wilson for that one. And I can't remember who else he brought on, but those substitutions were sort of, we talked about it at the time, this like, well, we were completely dominating that game. It's not like it was a 3-1, but Aston Villa were in the game and were having a million chances. We completely dominated it. 3-1, we'll bring on more attacking players. We'll get a couple more goals, which we did. And that sort of sets the tone for the season. Well, that's what it felt like at the time. And then, of course, pecs rip and feet break and gambling happens. And the whole season, we haven't been able to see like that style of play from a substitution perspective. And yesterday, it just confirmed that that is what he wants to be doing. He did not make like-for-like substitutions yesterday. We were 3-1 up when we brought on Wilson. Yeah, again, similar sort of thing. Dominating the game, really looked comfortable. And it wasn't like Isak off for Wilson. It's like, let's get those two lads up. It was almost like a 4-2-4 and just like keep pushing up the pitch. And I really, really love that. I really like seeing that. I think that we've talked a lot, as Alex said, about next season and what next season's going to look like and are we worried and things like that. But I think if that's our intention and that's the way we want to be playing, I think we have a lot of personnel who will be coming back into the team to offer us that. And that excites me. I thought it was mint yesterday.
Totally agree. And it's a little bit harsh on Eddie Howe, I suppose, that there's been so much discussion, particularly in the national media, about his job being safe and will Newcastle look to make a change when the guy literally has had to play with 11 on the pitch, or certainly 11 senior players on the pitch since November?
Months.
Pretty much. It's May, practically. It is kind of remarkable how damaging that's been, and yet Newcastle are favourites to finish sixth. You know, don't get me wrong, Newcastle have other structural issues, I think, in Newcastle. There's been some team selection stuff, but ultimately, even when we played Everton a few weeks ago, when Newcastle's second goal is disallowed, Everton immediately make like four substitutions, and then all of a sudden look really dangerous, and Newcastle just have nothing. Mm. And the fact that now it can change and that Wilson and Barnes can come on, arguably Barnes should be starting, but that's probably one for the review later on Patreon. It's just got to be a massive psychological boost and also a massive psychological deterrent to the opposition, where it's like, all right, 3-1, we need to get the next... Oh, look at the bench, shit. Callum Wilson's coming on, Harvey Barnes coming on. And that happened in the Aston Villa game, didn't it? Newcastle actually, at their best, finished these games more strongly. And what we've seen from Newcastle a lot this season because of that situation is they've actually finished games pretty badly, been a lot of late goals in there. But a massive benefit of the Eddie Howe era has been how strongly Castle have finished games and how they do end up winning games 3-4-5 because the last 20 minutes belongs to them. And that's kind of been impossible for them to do really since, well, I say in November, but really injuries have been all season long. So since kind of October, September. So yeah, happy days.
I think if you flip it as well and think about like that psychological element, it really makes me think about the Man City game at home in January. We had very little to shore up any kind of sort of defence or attacking threat. And obviously it's Man City, so that's an enormous caveat. But you look at their bench and Kevin De Bruyne is on their bench. And then Kevin De Bruyne comes on and it's just a collective groan around the stadium. I mean, how does that feel as a Newcastle player? Everybody just thought, yeah, they're definitely going to score. They're definitely going to score and probably win somehow, even though there's only 10 minutes left of the game. And like from a psychological point of view, we haven't had that threat. We haven't been able to offer that to any kind of opponent for 6 months plus. So I'm just buzzing that we have it back now, or at least a bit of it back.
And let's see, because Joe Linton supposed to be back before the end of the season. Pope, although that's not a bench thing, I think that would make a massive difference. To how Newcastle play Trippier, yeah. So gosh, how will it look against Brighton in a couple of weeks' time? Hopefully very good. Okay, we're going to leave it there for part one of the show, back after some adverts. Speak to you then.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Let's talk about Alexander Isak. It is 8 games in a row at St James's Park in which he has scored for Newcastle United. That equals a record Alan Shearer set back in 1996. A remarkable performance from him, a remarkable performance this season. It's now 19 goals in 23 Premier League games. These are elite figures from a world-class footballer. He is absolutely essential to Newcastle United, and while much of the conversation in the media pre-game surrounds Bruno Guimaraes, release clauses, how did Newcastle replace him, all this kind of stuff, there is probably an argument. In fact, I will nail my colours to that argument. Mast, in respect of he is our most important footballer. He is the player. I don't lose either of them, but he is the player that is simply irreplaceable. He's a striker. He's young. I often think, what can't he do? He's 6'1". He can score headers. He can beat players. He's a good finisher. He can go past players. He's got pace. He is the all-around package, and we saw it yet again yesterday. Just an all-around great day and a great season for Alexander Isak. Thoughts?
I'll go straight in. First and foremost, just one piece of skill that Isak showed yesterday for that equalising goal. It was outrageous. Do you remember last season when I think he took out like three players in about two sort of square inches. Was it Everton?
Everton, yeah, he danced around them.
This to me, what he did yesterday was the equivalent, right? I don't know how closely I've looked at the goal, but Murphy obviously has the ball out on the right-hand side. Cracking ball by Jacob Murphy, by the way. Channeling there, I don't know, channeling maybe sort of peak Messi there. But Isak, right, he dipped offside before Murphy hit the ball and dipped back in. So he basically slalomed in between two players in order to get a better position for the ball to be put through. It was sensational. It was like instinctively like intelligent. One of the best pieces of movement I've seen from a footballer at St. James Park. No exaggeration. If you just watch it back, it's absolutely beautiful. But in terms of his ability as a player, I mean, Alex, to say that he is probably our most irreplaceable player, I would agree. Anthony Gordon's up there, obviously. Bruno Guimaraes, of course, as you mentioned. But Isak, to me, is at this moment in time, is world class. The other two, you could make the argument, but I think Isak is clearly world class. He's one of the best forwards at this moment in the world, and that is an exaggeration. The statistics bear it out. And also, what is he, 23?
Yeah, I think
23
so
years old. Like he's still quite, as you say, he's 6'1", but he's still quite slim. You've got somebody here who, over the course of the next 4 years, is going to probably put on 5 kilos of muscle. So you put that onto him as well. I don't think he'll lose any of his pace because of it. It'll actually make him possibly a bit quicker and harder and stronger. And that'll mean that he'll really get better and better. It's a privilege. It's a privilege being able to see him in a Newcastle United shirt. It really is.
Agree with that. And just on the kind of that sort of dipping in and the instinctiveness of it, that sort of like channeling back, it's not the right word, but it's early, to come back onside. I don't think it's as instinctive because he often finds himself in the past few games, he's found himself in an offside position, and that's an area of his game he's working on. And I think what he's doing is constantly learning and constantly getting better. And it's these tweaks, because he's already so naturally brilliant. It's these little tweaks to his game that are just going to elevate and put us into the absolute best position.
The silly thing about him having to make those adjustments and learning is because he should just be getting the ball a bit earlier.
Yeah.
It's like he makes those runs. His runs are always really well timed, and he just needs that ball released by Murphy Esther in that one opportunity yesterday where it's an unbelievable ball. Like you say, I don't think Murphy did much else in the game, to be honest. His crossing was a bit off, but that was a sensational ball through. But you're right, he's had to learn about his teammates and think, right, I might not get the ball as quickly as I wanted, so I'm going to hold my run right, and then go. And that, yeah, it's brilliant. I'm going to say this just for Luis Enrique and Miguel Arteta and anyone else who's looking at Isak potentially. He has scored 9 pens out of his 19 goals. So he's not
really 9.
Yeah, 9 pens.
Yeah, wow. We've had loads.
He scored them all. So he's not that prolific if anyone's interested. We'll just keep him. We don't need to.
Well, I think all this Bruno chat and the release course chat, I think it is genuinely there to kind of put all the attention on Bruno and take away attention from Isak, because I think you're right. I don't want to lose either of them, but I think the club could get their head around maybe losing Bruno, particularly if there's a £100 million cash up front for him. And I think Isak, to Norman's point and to all our points, is a much harder kind of player to replace. Again, don't want to have to replace either of them. I really want to be very clear on that. But I think all this noise is to obfuscate kind of Isak and how much money it would cost for him.
Hopefully. I suppose the other thing about that first goal as well, that I think he's maybe learned or been told, is like, just don't take too many touches. Because again, at Palace, I thought he was a bit indecisive and therefore ended up taking one too many touches. He's done that quite a lot this season, whereas he just hit that first time, didn't he? He timed his run, got onto the ball and just hit it across the keeper. Unreal. Like, that's what you want. Instinctive first time shot. He knows where the goal is. Bang, goal. Give him too much time on the ball in front of goal. He seems to almost want to take too many touches and walk it in, which he's capable of doing. But sometimes you just want him to get a shot off. Like Palace game is very different. If that one-on-one he gets put through, I think it's Longstaff who puts him through. Just thought I'd give that a mention. and he takes one too many touches and the keeper gets it. Like, they're the things that I hope he's working on and just kind of being a bit more instinctive and just getting shots off because he's got a hell of a shot on him and he should take them more.
The last time he started a game at St James's Park in the league and didn't score was Manchester United back in December, which was the last time also Nick Pope played for Newcastle, so it feels like a lifetime ago. It's an incredible statistic. And I think size nine, so he's on 23 for the season, all comps, so I think it's 9 out of that 23. Because I don't think it's 9 in the Premier League. I didn't know that he'd scored 9 penalties for Newcastle. That's a remarkable. That's like Shaw-Ramy Obiebel levels of reliability from the penalty spot. Which is also hilarious that the players have clearly had to stop doing the pretend like, oh, Kieran Trippier, Andy Gordon's going to take it. Like, there's only one man going to take this penalty. I think the thing that we've got from him this second half of the season, which is so good, even though he missed a couple of games, Luton and Bournemouth, I think, but it's that reliability factor. Like, even when we started the season, we had two strikers who just couldn't keep themselves fit long term, and Villa got injured, but if he can play these last 5 games and he'd have put together a good run of 10-15 games, starting every game, finishing every game, because that's the reason, or one of the reasons Newcastle got him, because his injury record wasn't bad in Spain at all. He had suffered a kind of one injury hit season, but it shouldn't be this, but it is, that all of those things I listed that Isak can do before, if he can stay fit, if he can play lots of games and stay fit, then again, his value just, you're almost getting into silly figures. If we paid 64 million for him as a kind of raw talent from La Liga, you know, what's he worth now? You know, double, triple? You know, like we're talking about, maybe there isn't a value to Newcastle United that he could be worth because he's so replaceable. And there's a lot of conversation about replacing Callum Wilson this summer because his injury record this season has just been diabolical. But he still scores goals. He scored a goal yesterday. Eddie Howe spoke post-game about, you know, how hard it would be to replace Wilson's just sheer goal threat and goal return. It's true. But there is a sense as a fan, if we head it next season with Isak and Wilson again, you would just be thinking, we're going to do at least 6 more games without a striker because they're going to be injured at some point. So it's a really big thing for Newcastle to address this summer in what is a massive summer. But I don't know, Alexander Isak, I just feel like going to the match, it just settles you down, him being in the team, because he's just going to score.
He's up for the golden, he could be up for the golden boot as well, which is a pretty big achievement. Like, not something you ever think about from a Newcastle side.
Normally teams that finish 6th or 7th don't have.
Yeah.
Not anymore, it was maybe more a thing in the 90s or whatever, but.
He's one goal behind Haaland and Palmer. That's it. He's third in that race. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and Palmer scored, like, out of his 20 goals, at least 19 penalties.
Yeah, so yesterday, like you say, the Isak, the first goal that he scores is a good ball from Jacob Murphy down the line, and it's one of those, I haven't actually seen the XG for that shot, but it's not like a guaranteed goal. Yeah, like, when Isak goes into that position, I think Newcastle fans are generally appreciative of that. There's a good chance this goes in, but the ability to kind of finish in the side netting at the other side of the goal, like, the goalkeeper is covering his near post, but he almost thinks that if he's going to go across him, it's too tight an angle for him to get it in the post. He doesn't even die for it. It's just a remarkable finish. Really, really good.
I think what I love about Isak, and what it's something that I love about strikers more generally, and Wilson certainly has. Wilson has a lot of sort of, like, more like obvious arrogance about his talent and about scoring, and he's sort of like, like, when he scores, he's like, of course I scored. Like, here I am. I'm Callum Wilson. And that is not a criticism. You want your strikers to be arrogant. You want your strikers to back themselves to score. And so I don't have a problem with it. But Isak, there's more coolness about him. I know that the club and people always sort of tweet whenever he scores, like, ice cold and all of that. But it is. It's just, it's sort of this... You can't really read his face. It's just there's a self-belief there. There's a knowledge that he's going to score. But there's just this coolness, that penalty that he took yesterday. I just... And all of the other 8 penalties that he's scored this season. It almost feels like there's no daft run-up. There's no... It's not even a particularly fast run-up. It almost just feels too easy. And I know that it's not. I know that it's not easy to score a penalty. And I know that there's a lot of power behind that. But there's so much skill in in putting so much power behind something and it looking easy to everybody else. I haven't witnessed that in a really long time.
We'll leave it there for part two of the show. We're going to get on to the first half a little bit and also some other good performances after these. Let's talk about the bad stuff then a little bit, I suppose, and that would be Newcastle's first half, particularly the opening 25 minutes, but the first half as a whole, Si. We've talked about the need to get the points, and that's my view, but how worried were you at halftime yesterday?
And I was stood near you, and I think you can say I'm not revising my views. I wasn't worried at all. Now, I'm not saying the first half was good enough, and I think we need desperately to get a 90-minute performance out of Newcastle before the end of the season. That would be nice, because we just seem to have these bad spells, and at the minute, it's always at the start of the game. That said, like I said at the very start of the show, I just think Sheffield United came and went a bit gung-ho, and we weren't really expecting it. Brereton Diaz, I would love to see him as a backup kind of option. If we're talking about a third option for a front three, he was so problematic. He was on one side causing Tino and Cher problems. He basically got Cher injured, mm-hmm. and then he goes to the other side, and he's causing Byrne problems, and Byrne makes a really good goal line clearance, but the fact that he got through and was running that line perfectly and just kept getting in was causing us serious problems. And judging by Isak's post-match interview, in which he was asked about his penalties, but he said that they got a bollocking at halftime again, and we keep saying it's not sustainable to keep having to bollock your players at halftime, but I think Eddie Howe and the coaching staff have had to say to the lads, look, you thought you were going to win this. It's not as easy as that. You're going to have to work a bit harder to beat these. That said, on the flip side, Sheffield United, what they were doing wasn't sustainable. There was no way they were going to carry that on for the second half. So at 1-1 at halftime, I really thought, it's all right, we're going to win this. We'll probably win. We'll get an early goal, and then we'll just see it out, because taking the lead against them, they were never going to come back from it. I thought Sheffield United put everything into that first half. Probably if they hadn't conceded the Isak goal and had taken one of those other big chances, then we'd have a problem. But that didn't happen. Football doesn't always go exactly how you expect it to. No, I wasn't worried. I thought we had the quality. I also knew we had the two lads on the bench to come on, both of whom came on and impacted the game as well. Like, it was fine. I wasn't too worried. I am worried that kind of performance against a better side shouldn't happen, but I think it's down to complacency. I think the lads, as well as us in the crowd, just thought we'd walk this, and they ended up having to work for it, which they will have to do in the last four games as well.
I think if we hadn't scored just before halftime and equalised, I think it would have been a different story. But you did sort of feel, I suppose, even if we hadn't, you'd go into that halftime thinking we have enough quality. Sheffield will like crumble. They're not a very good side. They're probably getting relegated, and of course now definitely are getting relegated. My concern was less the quality that we have kind of on paper, on the bench and on the pitch, and more that with some of the sloppiness, because there were some really sloppy passes and some really sort of mistimed and confused looking players and just a bit of a mess at the beginning. My concern was the crowd, because it started to feel like it was just about to turn, and there was a lot of like, for fuck's sake, man, and a lot of that at the sort of mistimed passes. So Isak's goal, not necessarily for the end score, but for the crowd, was like an integral part of me feeling like it was going to be okay, because that buoyed people just before half time. And then we came, obviously there was the behind closed doors bollocking for a change. And then we came out and we were just much more dominant in the second half. And the crowd got behind the team and it was okay, but it did feel just like it was teetering on the brink of being grumbly, of being like, I'm just going to watch the second half inside and have a pint, or like, that kind of feeling. So that was my main concern, not necessarily the quality that we had. And then the crowd can get into the players' heads, obviously.
Well, I mean, we got a goal doing, but where I was going to score against Sheffield United, now that a goal's coming. And it's one of those where you think, well, actually, if we equalise, then they'll collapse. As against, they didn't. They could have gone 2-1 up. I think Brereton Diaz perhaps had a decent chance. They hit the post on the follow-up. Brooks put it just past the post. They could have gone 2-1 up. And I think while I was justified in saying on the post-match interview we could have been 3-1 up at half-time, he was absolutely right in doing that. So it was a poor first-half performance, but a couple of things. Fortunately, they're terrible at finishing. And I think actually you could look at the Spurs game and say we got a bit of luck there as well, because the two chances they had at 0-0 both fell to Timo Werner. We've allowed teams to kind of dominate the box for a very sort of brief period of the game against Spurs. Sheffield United, more or less the first half. What I will say is, with Nick Pope in goal, that kind of domination probably isn't going to happen. I'm not digging out Dubravka here, but Pope controls that box. They had so many men in the box, Sheffield United, at certain points yesterday. I just think with Nick Pope coming off the line quickly, as he does, that doesn't happen. They don't overload the box because Pope's already come out to claim the ball, or he's at least claimed the area territorially, and then that allows the defenders to push up ever so slightly higher, which then stops them getting as many men in the box. So I think, yeah, there's Sheffield United played well yesterday. They did overload. They did just go for the jugular. But stick Nick Pope in goal, I don't think they create half the chances that they did, to be honest.
What was interesting for me in the first half was that Sheffield United had identified Newcastle's left side as the problem side. So Newcastle, in terms of Hall, Gordon and Anderson, just got no time, no space. Whether it was Hall at left back or whether it was Anderson picking the ball at midfield, it was just we're going to overload that side defensively and we're going to make sure they've got no space to turn, no space to pass. We're going to take them out. We're going to foul them. And that's because Newcastle's right side was weak. In fact, even though the goal comes down there, which is always a risk that you take at Sheffield United when you're going to give Jacob Murphy that time and space, because they were basically like, Longstaff, Murphy, get the ball. We're okay with it. There was actually, just before Newcastle scored, ironic cheers from the Gallagher when Longstaff passed the ball forward, which is not something I've seen or witnessed in a long time. And Longstaff noticed it. He kind of turned around and looked and kind of stared at the crowd. But that was because the right side was just so sloppy, so poor. I mean, Longstaff gives the ball away for the corner Sheffield United getting the score from, which terribly defended set piece for Newcastle. But I felt like Newcastle played into Sheffield United's hands. Like, they didn't identify the fact, okay, if Sheffield United want to play, move everyone across to the left side, let's try and work that a little bit rather than continually going out wide to the right, which is what the opposition want us to do for the whole of the first half, not just when we got the goal, but when you've got a player like Alexander Isak, to be fair to Murphy, it was an excellent ball down the line. But, you know, if you're a Sheffield United fan, you're probably thinking, well, why is no one stopping and playing the ball? Well, that was the plan. It was like, give Longstaff the ball, give Murphy the ball. They'll probably give it to us back, which is what happened for a long time. And I feel like that, you know, even though Livramento did well yesterday, I thought eventually, at right back, you know, Kieran Trippier really does make that right side of the pitch in terms of the quality, in terms of the ability to find the pass, and particularly find the pass to a midfield player. When that's not there, Newcastle really struggle. And, you know, I don't plan to talk about Longstaff particularly. I mean, there is no one else to play. But even though he got a bit better in the second half, the guy is just not there at the minute in terms of the quality required at this level. There is no one else, so I'm not criticising the selection, not even criticising him. I just think objectively, he's dying on the pitch every single game in front of us. It must be awful for him, particularly if he's playing injured, but he is.
His confidence is gone, isn't
That's
it?
That's it.
Yeah, as well as the ironic kind of when he did play a ball forward to Murphy, there was another moment when he picked up the ball and didn't realise he had about 10 yards of space around him and then still popped it back off to Tino and got a massive groan from the crowd and people going, what the fuck are you doing? You got time to turn. And he looked up like, oh shit, what the hell? Like, you don't expect that as a player with your home crowd. And I think we can do better than getting on his back when things aren't going well. But yeah, the lad needs to come out the team. And yeah, you're right, there's no one who can come in for him. I think he's going to play four more games and probably not get much better. Let's hope we can carry him to the end of the season, because when the other lads are back, he needs just a stint out the team for his own benefit, for the team's benefit. And then when he comes back, if he's introduced, if we use him more sparingly, because the intention was never meant to be that Longstaff plays every minute of every game. Surely at the start of the season, when we've bought Tonali, we've got Joe Linton, we've got Anderson coming through.
Willock as well.
He was only meant to be part of the squad, and yet he's played like every bloody game. So and, you know, there's times when he might not have had to do that, but here we are. On their goal, by the way, it was slightly poorly defended. I'd say a little bit fortunate that the ball loops right the way across and beats everybody and it lands in the 6-yard box. And you think, well, like Norman says, if Nick Pope's there, he would have just claimed that. And then the keeper gets nutmegged as well from a shot that's taken like 3 yards out. Like, that's not ideal. It's a little bit fortunate. I'd say the ball is quite good and it just beats everybody. But yeah, again, I think with a better goalkeeper, that doesn't go in, and then it's a different game again.
Let's talk about Newcastle's left though, Norman, because you were really impressed. The game did open up. It's where Newcastle really started to find a lot of joy, and you were, particularly the two young lads playing, they're all young, but the youngest, Hall and Anderson, you were really impressed with.
I was meant to tie into what you were saying about the fact that Sheffield United did overload that side of the pitch and put a lot of pressure on. in that age is really important. Yeah, you know, you've said what the particularly the two younger lads. I mean, it is a very young, like Anthony Gordon's what, 23, 24 maybe. It's a really young, like sort of set of three lads on that left hand side of the pitch. Hall's still what, is he 19 maybe? Mm-hmm. Anderson 22 at most, I think 21 perhaps, and he hasn't got that much Premier League experience. Neither's Hall, right? And Sheffield United did overload that side, and it was obvious that it was causing problems. But my God, did they cope with it admirably? Like in terms of the amount of graft to put in, Hall was up and doing that line. Anderson was up and doing that line, but also he kind of had to go into the centre and help out quite a bit as well. He was putting tackles in. His movement is really, really good. He's hard. He's hard. He's a hard footballer. And Hall as well, it's the first time that I've noticed Hall really putting in good challenges. You know, I think one of the, maybe one of the areas on Hall, you look at and you think, is he a kind of tackling left-sided, like left back, is he the kind of player who will put in these tackles, or is he more of a sort of modern fullback who bombs up and doing the line, can skin players, can put crosses in, but actually defensively he's lacking a bit. Yesterday I saw a player who I think can defend, and I think with Hall, Anderson and Gordon, really you've got players who, if they play like five or six games together off the spin, they could develop an absolutely phenomenal understanding. And obviously we do have Willett, we do have Joe Linton, but there's an argument now that Elliot Anderson going forward will need to be in the team a lot more than he would be if those particular players were available. Do we need competition at left back? Of course we do. We need a sort of 24, 25 year old left back with loads of experience, because to play a Hall for an entire season, it's a tough one because of his age, because of, you know, the fact that he does need maybe, I don't know, some support in the sense that he needs possibly someone to learn from. I look at Livramento and I look at Trippier ahead of him, and I think Livramento must get so much out of that. It would be good to see Haaland in that kind of position perhaps. But in terms of how they played yesterday, mate, really, really impressed, because they dealt with the pressure and the physicality of Sheffield United exceptionally well. And obviously Anthony Gordon, very quickly, like how many penalties has that man won for? It must be a record, right? I mean, it seems to me he wins a penalty virtually every other week.
Yeah, and he's not just winning penalties that are kind of outrageous decisions from fullbacks or centre backs. He's winning penalties because before he receives the ball or before he takes his next action, he's thinking, how am I going to win a penalty here? And some of my people call it, it's not diving because he's clearly fouled and none of them were overturned by VAR, but he's added that to his game, not just goals and assists, but all, well, a penalty is an assist, but he's very smart about how he wins the penalties and draws the contact, and he makes sure it's not like sticking your leg out, you know, like the Sheffield United player on the overturned penalty for Murphy yesterday. It's full contact penalties, but the defenders haven't caught up yet with what they're up against in terms of Gordon. So it's a massive bonus to have him do it. And in addition, I've, you know, listened to some Spurs and some Arsenal and Liverpool fans this season who do podcasts. They're now lamenting that their players in certain positions, they're now saying Anthony Gordon will get a penalty there, they need to be smarter, Gordon will get a penalty, and they're right, they're spot on. Another massive contribution yesterday. So even when Gordon has not as influential a game or isn't on the ball as much as other games, he's still winning the crucial penalty that ultimately puts the game to bed. We'll leave it there, probably. Thanks to you guys for that really enjoyable conversation. We're on Patreon between £3 and £8 a month. There's a full, another podcast of reviewing this fixture called The Review, funnily enough, where the lads will talk through all the things we missed from this one, and then we'll do some more reaction to that, to this game this week, and build up to Burnley next weekend, which is another very big game, away game, so much harder for Newcastle because we're not the rampant force that we are at St James's Park away from home. So link in the description to this podcast to come and join us on there. It's between £3 and £8 a month. We'll speak to you again through the week. Bye-bye.